Welcome to the Chief of Anything podcast, in this four-tone vierklang format with Catherine Wutz and Dominik Klimek. Our vierklang format talks about the interplay of purpose, vision, values and strategies, and about what happens to companies when we bring these four together. Here I hear firsthand how the vierklang strategy has transformed companies and what I can expect from its implementation.
Hello, Dominik. How are you doing today?
Hello, Catherine. I'm doing wonderful. I feel very relaxed today. What about you?
I am very excited because I'm in travel excitement. Travel fever, I think, is the term. Going on a holiday on Monday, and I'm even more excited to have a podcast that's been in the making for a while happening today. We've got the wonderful Cindy Nedobity with us today. She first learned about the vierklang of purpose, vision, values, and strategies in her time at Vodafone Australia, and now works for AT&T in the US, but is based in Prague. So it's a truly international podcast we're having today. Cindy, it's wonderful to have you. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Lovely to meet you, Catherine and Dominik.
Wonderful. So Cindy, we always like to start these podcasts by asking people kind of like about their first experiences or most memorable experiences they've had with the vierklang of purpose, vision, values, and strategies. Is there anything that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, for sure. And I remember when we were kind of having a discussion earlier, you were saying, you know, what was the problem you were solving when you were thinking about the model? When the funny thing is, you didn't actually know you were living in a world where there was a problem. You just kind of sometimes felt a little bit off, like things didn't feel connected. They might not have laddered up to something. And you'd ask yourself, like, why am I doing this? Where is it going? What is the purpose of this? And I remember it was a long, long time ago, but I was kind of, most of my adult career has been with Vodafone. Actually, the majority of it's been with Vodafone. And I had the pleasure of working in the Australian business at a time where we were going through major transformation. And Graham Marr came in as the CEO at that time. So I'd worked with the previous CEO, then he came in. And I remember the first time I saw him on a flip chart paper draw those three circles. And I won't tell you that in that moment the penny dropped, because I don't think the penny did drop in that moment. But what they then did was rolled out like a bunch of kind of, I want to call them like integrated workshops. They might have called them training, but they weren't really training. They were very immersive. They were very integrated with all parts of the business. And I remember a particular part of model, which is the E plus R equals O. And I remember sitting there one moment and then like, I mean, I can change the outcome. Like I can do stuff with the middle of this equation and I can yield something really, really different. And I remember that being, I still use that particular part of the model so much in my current day. That was when the moment when the penny dropped and I realized, aha, so this is about something, a bigger purpose than just me as an individual. It's about the company going for something completely transformative, completely differently, and showing everybody from, you know, and I started in the call center, for example, taking calls right from that kind of role all the way through to my most senior roles. How do you put pieces together that helps you bring something much bigger than me as an individual to life? And it's beyond the making money bit, which is kind of the thing you don't hear in businesses. And I've worked since that time, I've worked in lots of kind of organizations. It's not always about that. And so much of that is driven definitely by the people and the leader of the organization. But yeah, that was probably the moment where I realized that model can do something really, really different to anything that I've ever known before.
You said something very interesting. You said you were working at Vodafone Australia, then Graham Marr comes in and he draws up three circles. Right? By that you mean like the purpose, the vision, the values and the strategies. And then it didn't click, and it clicked when he introduced a model called E plus R equals O. What does this mean?
In my layman terms, because this is the way I now use it, and I apologize immensely to the person that ran that session at that time if I get it wrong. But for me, it talks about there are events or there are things that happen in your life. And then there is a response, sometimes a reaction rather than a response, that yields a particular outcome. And it was positioned and framed in a way, my brain works quite mathematically. So when I saw it drawn out as an equation, it was like, well, it's an equation. It's completely solvable. If I want a different outcome, I either got to not react and respond, or I've got to change the way that I'm responding to a particular situation to yield a different outcome. And I will tell you, Dominique, I use that in my work life tremendously. I also use it in my personal life, because for me, that is a tool that is not a, it's maybe originated as a business tool, but it's a tool that is applicable across everything that you do with your life. I'll tell you, it's harder to do it with your children because they don't always work in the most rational way, but you start to pick up their patterns and you start to know how to modify your response. But yeah, hopefully that kind of, for me, sums up what that model is.
Okay, so basically the O, like E plus R equals O. O is the outcome, then yes. E stands for event, and yes. Then I have a choice. So usually an event is happening, then I have my R, my reaction, and a reaction is usually like I use a trigger. I'm just triggered, and then I get a really bad outcome because I was triggered and didn't think about it. But exactly. When I'm not reacting, when I choose a response and I consciously decide how will I react on this event, then I can create a much better outcome. Is that correct? Yeah,
that's exactly right. I joke with my husband sometimes, you know, when I'm going to have a reaction to something rather than a response. I'm having an amygdala hijack moment right now. So I'm having a moment where I am feeling like I'm not going to be in control of this R. But yeah, spot on, Dominique.
Okay. And how did this then relate to make the penny drop with regards to the Vierklang? Because you said you saw the Vierklang, that grandma said like, okay, this is our purpose, our vision, our values, our strategy. This is how I'm going to run this company with all of you. And then I have this E plus R equals O method. How did this tie up to form this team?
I think for me, what it did, there's a number of other practical tools that come out of the purpose-based or vision-based organization, but it put the power back in my hands. Very, very often in organizations, I think individuals are waiting for someone to do something for them. Someone's going to come and say to me, someone's going to come and tell me what I need to do. But if you're clear on where we're going and why we're doing something, and then you empower somebody by saying, actually, you can change the outcome to get there. You're actually in control of the things you can do. Now, there might be, as with any organizations, we're commercial organizations, there might be parameters and goalposts and guidelines and things you need to stick with. But they're healthy. I view those as like positive from that context. But then giving me the ability to go, I actually want to kick the ball over there rather than everybody saying we need to kick the ball in this particular direction. So I find, like I found it, I still find it quite empowering because it takes you out of a victim mode and it puts you completely in the driver's seat in every opportunity. So, and when I talk about the penny drop, I'd say there was a clear, you know, delineation between how it was before and how it was after. And that penny drop, that was a series of courses actually that we went through or immersive training. It wasn't just that moment. I remember that moment very distinctly. Like it resonated with me, so I deeply connected with it, but I know it was part of something much broader at that time. And the reason it was so like black and white in my mind is it wasn't like that before. It was very much you come in, you do as you're told. There are other senior, more important people who know what the right things are to do, and you just go and do it. Whereas the model flips that on its head and it says, actually, everybody brings a level of value. The fact that I'm a CEO or a director or the fact that I'm a call center person, I'm great at the job that I do and I'm just as important a voice as any other voice. And you put me in the driver's seat to actually influence the change in my direct area. So that's probably how I kind of am able to connect it. And it's great because if I think now since then into my future jobs, it always makes you remember the, you know, the like, you know, particularly COVID times, the faces on the other side of the camera, the people in the room, and really empathetically understanding what they might be going through, the shoes that they're wearing, and also helping them to draw out and recognize that they can seek something different, that they can do something different. And often the barriers or the things that they're seeking are things that they've put upon themselves, not that somebody in an organization or around them or me as a leader might have done, for example. So it's cool how you build on it, you morph it, you make it your own in many ways. But yeah, hopefully that helps to paint the picture there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Cindy, for explaining that a bit more. I'm really curious to hear, you were saying, you know, what made the penny drop was the difference from before and after. So what were some concrete things that really changed, kind of like maybe from your perspective as, you know, a call center employee at that time, or even experiences from other organizations, kind of like, well, how does it feel differently? How is working different when you work in a purpose-led organization?
Probably a couple of things, and I'll go with them in kind of a random order, no specific order. And I kind of alluded to this a little bit before, but all the voices matter. And at the time when I was learning about the model, I was quite a few years into Vodafone, so wasn't in the call center role at that time. But one of the transformative changes that happened as part of that was we started to hear a lot more about the voice of the customer. And that meant giving voices to people that were connected the most with the customer. And usually, we all know, those people are often considered the more junior people in our organizations. And probably their role is less valued. In the purpose-based model, where we're really driven by the customer, having those voices at the table, giving them a forum. And I'm talking like a forum with executive leadership. So they got to be at the table. They got to express their concerns either about their employee experience, which then prohibited them from delivering a great customer experience, or directly what they're hearing from the customer. So that is a very distinct polarization around, hey, we know what the right thing is to do. Let's just go to, we know what people want. We know what customers want, versus in the purpose-based model, your ears are out there much more. You are much more in, I'm going to listen, I'm going to absorb information, and the voices that are at the table are really important. So that's kind of one distinct component that I remember. And I remember in Vodafone Australia, like, we really, really needed that. We were in such a, you know, the business was like the black sheep of the family. It was constantly being called out. It was having, it was unlike many of the other Vodafone businesses. It wasn't coming from a dominant number one position, or not even a dominant number two. It was a challenger third brand. And it needed to behave in a way which was slightly different to how our brands might have behaved in other markets. And I don't mean in terms of the essence of what it stood for, but how it showed up to people, what it represented for people, what it actually freed people from in terms of what that market had been experiencing. So having the voice of the customer at the table was really pivotal in actually bringing that to life. I'd say the second thing, and I saw this mainly in Australia, because when I later moved to Qatar, we had a great opportunity to set up that team from scratch. And it was probably one of the most talented groups of people I've ever worked with was in the Qatar business. If you think back to the Australian business, and this is probably another one of my favorite models that I use in my everyday business and talk about often, but how much does the cost of a high-performing, non-values-aligned person really cost the business? And it would not have been uncommon in those early days to see people that were performing well stick around for a long, long time, because assessment of performance was always on the what specifically did you achieve? How many units did you sell? How much revenue did you bring? But the cost part of that equation, well, how do you go about doing that? Is it at the cost of others around you? Are you the type of person that just doesn't make it a great place to be? And in the non-values-based organization model, without purpose, you don't get that kind of evaluation. You get the evaluation on the straight, this is what that individual did. And there is almost a blinkering of, but at what cost? What did it come at? And I remember, you know, I can, like, so many times sitting on beanbags, looking at Graham on his flip charts, drawing it out. Like, you know, people that are high performers, people that are really values aligned, they're like gold in your business. You want to keep them. You got someone who's really values aligned and not performing. They probably need a little bit of help to get them to the next level. Or maybe they're not in the right role, but they probably still deserve a chance in your business. The really clear one is somebody that's not values aligned and not performing, and that's people don't usually have that much issues. The tricky one, and the one which, you know, we'd call it organizational cancer in many ways, is people that are bringing you what you think is a result, but they're really doing it in a way which is detrimental to the culture and the values of the organization. So, and the reason I spent a bit of time talking about that model, I remember as part of that transformation, there was a really, really big period of time, which was the chaos that you had to work through before you got to kind of your standard operating model, which was you had to get a lot of people off the bus because they just weren't organizationally the right fit anymore. They might have been delivering a result, and that's really hard for an organization to stomach, because the immediate thought is, well, how do I plug that gap? Actually, what they quickly realize is if you get that out, you will see flourishment in all of the other people around who've been suppressed or weakened or compromised because they feel that way in that scenario where people exist. So that's kind of when just as a couple of examples of what it felt like before and after. So that tremendous focus on the customer and bringing the voice of the customer, and then the tremendous articulating what it means to exist in a PBO or a VBO as an individual being and my role and what is or isn't accepted, and making those really hard calls that are visible because they send a really strong message around commitment to the model to the rest of the organization. So I think for me, that's kind of just maybe shows you some of that feeling. And look, don't get me wrong. It's not like, hey, performance and results comes easy. It doesn't. You still have to work tremendously at all of that stuff, but you capture people's hearts because people just, A, they're sold into something beyond making money because we all want to have a personal purpose that is usually beyond that. I don't think we all wake up and want to just make the shareholder dollar that day. So this gives you something that's more than that to wake up to, and you feel kind of really fulfilled. But you're also doing it in a place where you feel really great every day about waking up and going, and you know you can have an impact, you know you can make a difference, and you really know that it's recognized and appreciated. So that's kind of what it felt like operating in that mode.
And I can imagine it's always very difficult. I have a high performance person that is just not a value fit, that maybe that person doesn't believe in the purpose, the vision. They are just here, I'm only here to make money. And to let someone like this go might seem a little bit challenging in the beginning because this person brings money in. How long did it take until this person, like in Vodafone Australia, these people that had to leave, how long did it take for the company spirit to really change? Because now I have only people in my team, like there's a true team, that all care about my purpose, the vision, the values, and the strategies, that want to work together and not against. They care about each other and are not these lone wolves just going out there for by themselves. How long did it take until performance was back at the basic level before these high-performance, non-value-fit people left?
And I'm thinking back now, we've got the benefit of hindsight from all that time ago. And when I think about the transformation and how it happened, like it's very easy to wrap it to a moment in time or a very short period in time, because that's how our mind kind of works and we forget the pain before and the pain after. But if I can remember that time clearly, first of all, there's work that happened at the executive level, and that's probably like a couple of months. And that is a quick, there's a new CEO on board. Are we doing this? Are you on board? This is how we're going. And then begins the organizational journey. And the organizational journey, it isn't about clearing those people out immediately, because sometimes it's actually not known till you build out your values, till you build out, you know, where are we going? What's our purpose? What's our vision? How are we going to get there? It's then that you've now all of a sudden got, I don't want to call it a measuring stick, but you've got something by which you're able to assess the organization. And that rollout, because the way that happened to the leadership team first, and then it was about the filtering down. Now, Graham was tremendous in his ability to connect at leadership levels as well as kind of at every level in the organization. So he was doing a lot of that in parallel. And I would say, realistically, if I think about moving some of the key people out of the business, I want to say about months 5 to 6 to 7 to 8, that's the period of time when a lot of that assessment was happening. And I will tell you, Dominic, it did not take long for performance to quickly get to the level that it was and then surpass it at a much greater rate than what it had been in previous years. And at the time in that business, we were having, you know, really sizable efforts around kind of our margin implications, like where our margin was operating, what we were trying to attain in terms of growth and really being a challenger third brand. Because when they transformed the business, hopefully that answers your question, Dominic. I just want to add a little bit more context, because it wasn't like those activities happened in isolation. Because at the same time, when we were going through that internal transformation, we were also thinking around, how do we manifest this change externally to customers? How do we give customers the sense that we're a different organization, that we're here and we exist because the customer is at the core of what we do. So it was coupled at a period of time after extensive internal alignment and gearing with like a massive external campaign. Now, I will say to you, there was post that event, some people were in favor of that campaign, not in favor. They think it did or didn't do what they might have anticipated. But what it definitely did was created massive transformative shift in the way that customers and consumers perceived us in the market. And it really put us in a very solid challenger position. They really started to see Vodafone in a very different light to a, it's a struggling third entrant that might not make it, to how we've actually now got a challenger brand that's really arrived. And the reason I mention that is I think it's, for me, the reason that period was so successful, it wasn't only about the inward-looking stuff that we needed to do to get our shop right, but there was a lot of external focus on making sure that we were taking the customer with us. So it wasn't like, let's get our shop in order for 18 months and then let's think about what we're going to do for the customer. It didn't happen in that way. Those streams actually ran in parallel. So when I talk about performance got there quickly and then surpassed, it was coupled with making some really big changes externally in the market.
Cindy, you were saying earlier, so kind of like two very key things that happened were that, you know, everybody got a voice. And now we had the topic of, well, let's take the people out who might be high performance, but low value fit. And then that's actually going to transform the business. It's going to get, you know, that voice to the customer. It's going to make us look different. People are going to perceive us differently. And the people who work in the business are really going to get that extra push to flourish, because the ones who've been sabotaging the how, right, they are no longer there. Now, if, you know, we think about our listeners who, you know, might be running businesses themselves, and we've sometimes heard from them, you know what, that's kind of a scary thing to do. It's a scary thing to give everybody a voice, because then doesn't that mean it's utter chaos and we don't get anything done? And then you tell me to take out some of my highest performers. Well, that's going to give me a huge hit, right? So what would you tell them, kind of like if they are at a decision where they notice, hey, there is a few things that I need to change, but there is very real fear there to make those changes?
Yeah, perfect. I like that question a lot. And it is scary. So one thing I do remember during that time is like people's inability to act can sometimes be driven by will, but often is driven by fear, as well as to the unknown. Like, what does this then mean? I'm still going to be held to account for a result. On the voice of the customer one, I think there is a difference between actively listening and then communicating or committing that you're going to make all of the change that you've heard. I think one of the things that you need to do in that scenario is you need to create transparency in how you're going to make the decisions. How are you going to filter and how are you going to cluster the voices that you're hearing? And how are you then going to take what you think is most important and actually make it happen? The feeling before was, firstly, you couldn't have a voice. Like, you didn't resonate. You didn't have anywhere to go. There was no formalized mechanism of sitting anywhere at a table. So when I talk about having a voice at the table, I'm talking about there were representatives picked from call centers to represent their folks. So they would go and they would scour across the teams, and the honor they had in every quarter, we changed the voice out, in coming and sitting in an executive boardroom with the CEO and sharing what they felt were the biggest things, that is tremendous in terms of the benefit. Now, did that feel like chaos? I'd say not at all, because what you'd all of a sudden done is given people a voice at the table in a very organized way. It's very uplifting, very empowering, and you then have to make sure that the feedback flow was there. So you have to then take that information, you have to feedback what were you doing. Some things don't always make it and some things do make it, but if you can explain to people the why the decision was made. And when I talk about giving people a voice at the table, it's really, you do have to be careful, because it's not about swaying in each and every direction based on what everyone thinks it's the right thing to do. You still got a strategy. You still got a vision of where you're trying to go, and you need to stay true to the course on that. But it's about recognizing that others have great ideas that can accelerate you or do it in a different way that yields a better outcome. And it's about how do you filter those in? So I kind of view that as, like, organize the way that it comes in, be transparent and clear about how you're going to use that, and make sure you create a feedback loop back to those individuals so they can then help to spread the word around how things are done. So I think that's kind of the first thing. On the people thing, it is harder. It is much harder, because there is also relationships that are happening in the organization. So you got to kind of manage for that. And then there's the real thing, which is the performance. And I think you have to accept when you're in that period of transformative change And there is a, I want to call it like a silent contract. There is an agreement that we're all in this together, that we believe in this model, and it's yields an enterprise benefit. And I sometimes need to suboptimize for a small period of time on a result that I've got, but I know I'm going to get it there by what I'm doing. And the reason I say you have to be careful about that, I don't think, and I don't recall my time in Vodafone, we didn't do all of those people changes in a specific moment of time. That's not the way that that happened. You have to kind of organize the way that you go through that. And that, what is, you know, you can say, well, that means you have to tolerate some of that behavior for a longer bit. The business has tolerated that behavior for a very long time and had still survived. You're talking about how do I effectively transition and transform the organization during that period of chaos, also not to break it, because you also kind of need it to come out on the other side. So, but I don't think the answer is don't do it because it's scary. I think the answer is what's the best way to juggle all of these bits together that get me to that right outcome? Hopefully that, makes sense.
Absolutely.
To your question. Yeah, good.
Absolutely. And the way you've just explained it, it comes back to E plus R equals O, right? What's the outcome I want to achieve in the business? What's the event that's going to happen? And how am I going to make that happen, right? So what are the things I can control to get to the outcome that I want?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Good example. I have a personal experience and a personal story about making a decision to leave an organization when I couldn't personally connect with the, well, I wouldn't call it a values or a purpose-based organization. You'd like to think it is when you're kind of interviewing and going through that phase. But I remember I worked a long time, and even though it was after my Vodafone days, I worked long at trying to change the event in that situation because I'd been promised a different event. So I kind of like forgot my ways for a bit and really tried to change the event because I was pitched a different event, and time I'd rock up there. As we all know, the event is not going to change. The event is the event. And I kept, you know, and I'd tweak my response. I'd really think through my response. I'd remember I'd strategize with my husband about how can I do this differently to yield a different outcome. And there does come a point where you have to accept that the outcome in that scenario is actually leaving the business. Like I couldn't change the outcome of being there. And I had to make a call. And that, you know, that was a tremendous, tremendous learning curve in my life at that time. I'd been with one company for a very long time. I felt like I was brave. I was jumping to do something different. I was going to another country. I was very excited about the brand, tremendously excited about the brand. And then after like a long time of trying to make that happen, I realized that I was actually not delivering my best and I wasn't getting the best out of myself because I was probably just shattering my confidence the further along we went. So I completely changed my response and I got a different outcome to what I was expecting, but it was 100% the right outcome. But I just wanted to give you an example of something on a personal level using that model or applying that model to yield, probably something that I hadn't quite anticipated. But when the penny dropped, and I was able to actually act quickly once that became obvious to me.
Yeah, I think it's like always like the same structure because there's an event or there's something like this is how a company does something. And maybe I do know better and I have tried 15 times, 20 times, 30 times to change it. And I'm always doing this because I have good intent, because I want the business to strive more. And some bosses are just like reluctant to that change. And if I cannot do anything, there is a valid option to just leave the business. Because when I'm a good employee, I want to be seen. And if my boss is blocking me from doing that, good people usually leave. It's always the same.
It's really nice the way you've described it, Dominique, because that's exactly how it felt. And what was interesting in this particular scenario, because it was actually working directly for the CEO at that time, all of the right things were said. All of the right things were said when we would meet and have the discussion, but the actions that then ensued were just completely at a misalignment with what was being said. And, when I kind of think about that now in hindsight, I think the right things were said because there was a group organization somewhere that was perhaps insisting that that was the way things were said. And I perhaps was recruited more from a group perspective rather than a local perspective. And I really believe there was no ill intent or malice on the people on the ground. I just think there was just the the scary and the fear of the change and allowing things or believing that things could be better or could be different because they had a winning proven formula doing things a particular way, but the world had moved on and times had moved on. So I don't share that story because I'm, you know, angry or bitter at the individuals. Like, I am extremely grateful and thankful for my time there because it gave me a very different perspective to the one that I'm used to. But you're spot on. You must remember that you always do have still a choice, and sometimes that is absolutely the right outcome. I'm sure they probably felt relief because it was hard having somebody like me saying, we could be better, we can do better. They're like, we're happy. So it was probably good for them, and for sure it was good for me. But I really love the way, Dominique, that you just described that. That's exactly how it felt existing in that environment in that time.
Wonderful. It reminds me of that Peter Drucker quote, right? Culture eats strategy for breakfast. Sort of, you know, it's the way we do stuff around here, you know, that's just how it's always been. Why should we do differently? And then, as you've said, often people have the best intent. And in German, we have this saying, it's actions speak louder than words, right? So oftentimes we like hearing what we say. It doesn't mean we also act to it. And recognizing that always sounds so easy looking back at it. But when you're in it in the moment, that's actually quite a task to distinguish that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, Graham used to have a saying, and he'd say, it's easy to tell what people value. Just let me have a look at their bank account. And the idea was, and that bank account was like a monetary bank account, but then a time bank account, because he'd say people spend their money and their time generally on the things that they value. So it's easy to see what do people really value, not only what do they give airtime to valuing. And I will say I've seen it in, you know, my career up till now. It's actually, you know, we used to say like dis-ease creates disease in people. So, you know, be careful about dis-ease. And he, you know, we'd often talk about where does dis-ease come from? Dis-ease comes from a lack of congruity between what your organization might be asking you to do or a way of behaving and what your true being is and how you like to behave. And you know, you need to show up somewhere and be something. And if it's not aligned, and we have this in conflict scenarios, not only in a work environment, but even in personal and relationship, where if you no longer are aligned in kind of what you value and how you want to operate, it creates a level of discomfort or dis-ease. And we used to always say, be careful about dis-ease because it gets you in the long run. So make sure you're creating alignment. And you know, people sometimes focus, well, I use a different word. It's not so much about the word. Don't get caught up on the four words that a company puts up as their values. It's the culture that is walking around them. It's the things you feel that I can't describe just in a word on a wall. And that's what you got to ask yourself. Do I feel at home in that scenario or not? Do I feel comfortable? Am I at ease? And if I'm not, you know, and I did a very, 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 very small project for a company that was doing, you know, online gambling. And I'm talking like a couple of weeks. And I remember coming to my husband after 1 week, I said, I can't do this. I said, I'm having a personal, I am at dis-ease. I'm a marketeer by origin. And I'm sitting there thinking how to grow the share of wallets of the household spend of families. And I understand these customers, I understand the demographic, having sat on numerous focus groups. And it is counter to everything I stand for. Like, I'm about, you know, families prospering and growing. And here we are thinking, how do we take money away from mouths at tables and families and doing so? And I kind of went in the next sass, like, I'm so sorry. I can't do this. Like, I'm having a real, and please don't take it as a, you know, you have to also position it in a way which is not reflective of the other individuals, because that's my value statement. I don't want to inflict that on anybody. But you have to do that with a, you know, level of care and empathy so that it's also the message is received in the nice way when you're delivering it. But yeah, that's another good example of the incongruency and taking action in those moments that matter, because you then just start to eat yourself up if you just do it for the money. I wasn't going to another job. I wasn't doing anything else, but it was like, nah, I don't want that. So that's probably another, I'd forgotten about that. You know, I'd buried that somewhere in my head. So just having this discussion is interesting how it flushes things to the surface.
Yeah, it's so mind-boggling. I mean, when people start their career, they usually say like, oh, well, I'll take the highest paying job. And over the course of a career, I realize this is who I am. This is what I stand for. And once when I know like, this is who I am, these are my values, this is what I'm good at, this is what I don't like to do. When I'm arrived at this level, then I can create a plan, like this is my career in the next 5-10 years, and then I can find a company that's accompanying me on that path, and I can find a company that fits to me, that has similar values, and then I have fulfillment, like true fulfillment when I go to work daily. It's not this, oh my God, it's Monday, I have to go to work again. It's like wonderful. I can just like my Sunday was awesome. Saturday was awesome. And now I'm having another awesome day in the office because I'm still doing what I personally love. It fits to me and it's just something I would do even if I wouldn't get money. And I believe once people have found this, they are like truly happy and have the chance to fulfillment.
Yeah, I agree, Dominic. And you got me thinking there as you were chatting. I remember it's not often there are external events of such a nature that create such worldwide impact like COVID did. And your story is, I'm connecting with your story because at the time I was with AT&T during that time and, you know, in the US and actually internationally, there's the idea of the Great Resignation. And we were seeing, you know, high levels of attrition, like any company was at that time in our call centers. And when we were digging underneath the data and we were doing looking a lot of the, you know, Gartner research and McKinsey research at that time and a lot of external, and it was fascinating to me because people were resigning in greater loads than they'd ever done before and they were not going to other jobs. They were not going to other jobs. And the underlying thing that you were seeing emerge, and it took an event like COVID to stop you, to make you think. People had lost loved ones. People had transformed their way of working. The home environment was completely different to how it was. And what you were hearing to start to emerge when people were talking about the Great Resignation is people felt that they had a different life purpose to the one that they'd been on a trajectory to. They felt like they no longer connected with the company that they were working for and the direction and the path that it was taking. And COVID was that moment in time that kind of like pulled fuel on the fire, if you like, and it helped people to completely reassess their life. Like I remember us looking for like little golden nuggets, like is it about the pay? Is it about this bit? Is it about that bit? And actually you just stood back and you go, it's actually got nothing to do with it. It's about something transformative that's happened for the individual. And I use that example because you meet people from time to time and they have that experience that you're talking about. I've never in my whole working career had a moment in time where such a volume of people were doing it, but driven by something that I'm sure all of us, or hopefully all of us, will only experience one in our lifetime. But like COVID was a great external situation, which really kind of accelerated that for a lot of people. Like fascinating times. I remember I was blown away at that time by that because I'm like, this is VBO and PBO in practice in the external world environment. People are taking this on and translating it for themselves in that way. It just took an event to kind of cause that that reflective thinking.
And without my personal purpose, I'm like a ship without a rudder. I'm just going where the river is flowing. And maybe I'm going to the right or left. And once I've discovered my own purpose in life, I first get my rudder, I get a steering wheel, and then I can determine, do I want to go upstream? Do I want to go downstream? What do I do here? And this is the truly like the one moment where I take my own destiny back into my own hands. And that's so important to figure this out.
Brilliant.
And then go along with it.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I love how that puts like a different spin on something, you know, like COVID that has had a lot of negative effects and people talk about that a lot, right? And also putting the focus on, hey, it really slowed us down. It gave us, you know, the chance to think. It took you out of your, you know, we call it the hamster wheel over here. So kind of like, you know, you start running and you keep running and it, you know, you're staying in the same spot in a way, right? So in the image. So having that force to slow you down, to think, to reevaluate, and then also have a clear look as to, hey, is what I'm doing actually in alignment with where I want to go? Or do I want to go somewhere else? And I don't know, my experience has been whenever people have made that decision, it took them to a much better place, and it might have taken them into different businesses. And that might have been a reflection of the fact that they weren't in the right business to start out with. And then that gave a chance for other people who were exactly right in that spot to occupy that spot and contribute to something bigger than themselves as well, right? To come back to that whole purpose notion. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Cindy. It's been an absolute blast, and time is flying, and I could listen to your stories for another 2 hours or so. Absolutely gladly. Thank you so much for having made the time to be here with us, to share your stories, and we look forward to reconnecting with you soon.
Thank you, Dominique, Catherine. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for listening to me, for hearing me out, and it's been an amazing trip down memory lane. So I'm feeling awesome on this Friday afternoon. I really appreciate that.
Wonderful. Thank you, Cindy. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for today with Vierklang Strategy Coaching in our Chief of Anything podcast. If you would like to discover the impact of Vierklang Strategy Coaching for your company, then simply click on the link in the description and get in touch with us.